This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Yaki on Culture and Race, Part 8. Picking up in Yaki's Imperium in a section he titled Tradition and Genius, page 262. From Cromwell to Joseph Chamberlain, the beginning and the end of that high political tradition which built the great British Empire, which at its highest point exerted its control over 17/20 of the surface of this earth, England was the example of the possibility of the tradition in politics, as well as in philosophy, music, and the arts of form. How many men of political genius appeared in the premiership during these centuries? Only the two Pitts. Nevertheless, England emerged from all the general wars of those centuries with increased power. 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648, Spanish Succession War, 1702 to 1713, Austrian Succession Wars, 1741 to 1763, Napoleonic Wars, 1800 to 1815, Wars of German Unification, 1863 to 1871. Only one serious blunder was made during these centuries, the loss of America, 1775 to 1783. The essence of this tradition was nothing other than applying only political thinking to politics. Cromwell, the theologian, departed from this only occasionally, and more in words and expressions of sympathy than in actions. His successors in the tradition of empire building were not burdened with his heavy theological equipment, which they transformed into cant, a word translatable into no other European language. The technique of cant was what enabled English diplomacy to score continued successes in the world of facts, i.e., the world of violence, of cunning, of sin, while maintaining before itself the attitude of selfless morality. To enrich the country by new possession was thus, quote, bringing civilization, unquote, to, quote, backward, unquote, races, and so on, through the whole gamut of political tactics. Now, what Yaki is describing here is a period of time beginning with Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell, and ending with Joseph Chamberlain. And he says the only other two significant men to lead England during that time, the British Empire during that time, were these two men, the Pitts, a father and son team. And I'll provide links to all four of these men to give you a better idea who they are. I was not familiar with the Pitts at all, and I wasn't familiar with Joseph Chamberlain either. But this is one of the interesting things about Yaki, and you can imagine him sitting at his typewriter, typing all this out on the coast of Ireland with no internet and no reference books, really, nothing but his own memory, to list off these names and these the list of wars, which, I think that was important just to get a sense of just how much information was in this guy's head about European history and about European thinking. It really is awesome in the literal sense of that word. It inspires awe. Here we are again with this magic fraction that Yaki invokes. Previously he's mentioned it as 18/20 of the Earth's surface. Here he mentions it 17/20. I think the difference is that he's talking specifically about the British Empire as opposed to Western civilization, which is what he said ruled 18/20 of the Earth's surface. Cant is an interesting word. The meaning that Yaki is getting at here is actually a combination of two separate senses of the word. There's a meaning that means the private language of the underworld, specifically marginalized groups, thieves and beggars. And another sense of the word that has to do with the expression or repetition of conventional or trite opinions or sentiments, especially the insincere use of pious words. And he combines both of those, I think, in his description of how the politicians subsequent to Cromwell used this cant to advance the interests of the British Empire. He says it can't be expressed. It's a word that can't be expressed in any other European language, and maybe that's true. But I immediately what comes to mind is the Jews, of course, in my mind, and their Hasbara, and what I've often described as the Jewish narrative, and specifically the victim part of that, and the moralizing that's part of that. That's the trick to the Jewish narrative, is describing themselves as victims and setting themselves up as having the moral high ground to lecture and moralize to everyone else about how they should think and what they should do and so forth. And what Yaki describes as this idea of bringing civilization to backward races, I think of Tikkun Olam, this Jewish idea of repairing the world and their light, that they see themselves as a light unto the nations. So there is a parallel there, and I would even guess, just take an educated guess from what I know, that it was Jews who inspired this in the British politicians and British politics subsequent to Cromwell. And let's talk a little bit about Cromwell here. Cromwell ruled Britain from 1653 to 1658. Before that, he was a general, led the overthrow of Charles I, the King of Britain, and established himself in 1653 as Lord Protector of Britain. He's a very controversial figure. There are people who really despise Cromwell, and there are others who lionize him. And in the Wikipedia page that describes him, we see that Thomas Carlyle is one of the people who describe him or see him as a hero. And that's significant because in trying to understand why Yaki saw Cromwell as a significant genius, heroic figure of Britain, it's interesting, or it's important that to see that Thomas Carlyle does, because as we know from our discussion of Yaki's views on liberalism, that Yaki liked Carlyle, admired Carlyle's opinion. He described him as he was the Scottish philosopher who Yaki credited with trying to explain Prussianism to the English. This Prussianism being sort of proto-national socialism. As Lord Protector, this is specifically having to do with the Jews now, Cromwell was aware of the Jewish community's involvement in the economics of the Netherlands. At the time that Cromwell came to power, the Jews had been evicted from England hundreds of years earlier by Edward I. And supposedly, there weren't any Jews in Britain in Cromwell's time, but Cromwell was the one who allowed them back. He saw that the Jews in Netherland might help fund his own ambitions, and opened Britain back up to the Jews. And he was encouraged both by the economic considerations and his own Puritanism, or his own Christian beliefs, anyway, and his own ideas of tolerance. But the Jews were already back in London before Cromwell let them back in. There was a Jewish source that I found, or a Philo-Semitic source, say, describing this. And what they wrote is that since before 1640, which is 17 years earlier than Cromwell allowing them back in, there had been established in London a small colony of Sephardic Jews, Maranos, or Crypto-Jews, passing as Spanish merchants, and that the leader of this group had been in London since the 1630s, at least. so 25 years earlier than Cromwell had let them in, officially legitimatized them. And they used the word colony, that the Jews had set up a colony in London. And I think that's a good word to use for it, because that's certainly how the Jews see their living amongst their hosts. I had discovered earlier in my series of podcasts on the Mary Fagan murder that the Jews had come to Georgia in America very early on. In fact, a boatload of them had arrived right after the first settlers first set up the first English colony, British colony in Georgia in the 1730s. And that those Jews had come from London and only had recently arrived in London from Portugal, that they had lived as crypto-Jews. That is, they had lived as Jews, but in secret, because they were forbidden to be in Portugal for hundreds of years prior, but had lived there and then ultimately fled to London. And this was after Cromwell had allowed them to, but the colony had become so established in London by that time, less than 100 years after Cromwell, that they were now, they had become so capable that they were now helping to establish further Jewish colonies elsewhere, and in this case, in Georgia, in the New World. So it just goes to show you that the Jewish hand behind Cromwell and influencing Cromwell was significant. And yet, Yaki, I don't think that he was unaware of it necessarily, but for all of his broad knowledge of European history, left that part out. Maybe he was even unaware of it. Don't know. There's more on Joseph Chamberlain, but I don't want to get into the details there. It has to do with him being the premier during the Boer War, this, what's called the Second Boer War. But that was a disgusting chapter in European history in South Africa. And, of course, the Jews are involved in South Africa, too. There were Jews amongst the directors of the Dutch East India Company, which for 150 years had administered the colony at the Cape of Good Hope. And the Jews were also involved in the gold mines and diamond mines in South Africa. So, again, the Jews were involved, and this is something that Yaki just glosses over, doesn't even address. The pits, there's something there too. The older the father is described as, he displayed a commanding manner, brilliant rhetoric, and sharp debating skills that cleverly utilized broad literacy and historical knowledge, which Yaki wouldn't have been aware of this particular description since it's in Wikipedia, written decades after him, but he probably saw a bit of himself in the pits, because that description sounds an awful lot like other people's descriptions of Yaki himself. And again, all of these men, this is another odd thing about Yaki describing them as significant, and he could have been describing them as significant in the same way that Time magazine named Adolf Hitler Man of the Year, not necessarily out of admiration for these men, but just out of their genius. And we're going to get into that in a bit here about Yaki's idea of genius. He writes on page 266, continuing here, that the crass stupidity of rationalism and materialism was nowhere more perfect in evidence than in its attempt to make the word genius into an intelligence term. Naive tests, in quotes, were even devised to detect the presence of, quote, genius, which could be shown by a number. He's talking about IQ. In the age of materialism, there was no scruple about weighing and numbering the faculties of the soul. The fact is that intelligence is the functional opposite of genius. Intelligence is dissection. Genius is creation. One is analysis, the other is synthesis. The first is directed toward the part, the second toward the whole. They are related as terrestrial and astral, counting and imagining. Well, here's an example of Yaki's grand dichotomizing again, presenting these two aspects of intelligence as opposites at odds with each other, when that's not really what they are. He makes a valid point, I think, that there's more to intelligence than a single number can represent, a single dimension that IQ folds everything down into. IQ is valid, I think, as a measure of amplitude or as a one-dimensional measure once everything's folded together and considered in total. And the different types of intelligence do seem to be correlated with each other. And so it is valid in a sense to measure it along a single dimension. But you really have to realize that it is only a single dimension you're measuring. What Yaki is getting at here is right. I see it. I'm one of these people who specializes in analysis and dissection, which he puts on the side of intelligence as opposed to genius. A genius is more interested in creation and synthesis, according to Yaki. I've thought an awful lot about thinking myself before I ever got into race and the Jews and philosophy. I used to think an awful lot about thinking. I see a difference, for instance, between the type of thinking and thinkers which prefer to analogize, see things in terms of analogies, and those who prefer memorization. And there, again, I see a distinction between myself. I prefer analogies. I see relationships between things. Whereas Yaki tends to have a command over masses of facts, names, and dates. And so he's more into memorizing things. But, and I've seen this before described as the difference between mappers and packers, mappers being people who make maps of things and derive rules, and packers being the kind of people who memorize landmarks and the details of things. And the final point on this I'd like to make is just that I don't think it's an either or situation like Yaki paints it, whether it's analogy versus memorization or the analysts versus synthesis, intelligence versus genius. It's really more of a blend of both dimensions in all of these cases and probably other factors that I'm not even considering, as opposed to this black and white one or the other type of thing that Yaki insists on, you know, his grand dichotomizing, his way of seeing things. Page 268, he continues, "What precisely are the qualities of genius in politics, which constitute its maestria, that's a Spanish word meaning mastery or skill, and in its inner imperative? First, vision. It sees the possibilities of the future, and its mind is thereby freed from the trammels which hinder the average man in his thinking. To the prosaic mind, everything which is represents the end of all development. The future is to be a mere extension of the past. Second, spiritual purity. The ordinary man is an eclectic. He carries in his head hundreds of contradictory ideas and beliefs. Not so the creative man in politics. He thinks along one line and one line only. This gives to his enemies the opportunity of convincing many that he is mentally ill, and they have never failed to do so, from Alexander to the hero we have seen." I'll interject there to, for those who don't already know, the hero, and he capitalizes hero, that Yaki's talking about is Adolf Hitler. He dedicates his book to the hero of the Second World War, and those who understood him and knew him knew that he was talking about Adolf Hitler, and we'll get more into that in just a bit, continuing with Yaki here. But political genius and its enemies pass into two different categories of history. His name is written in bronze letters as the symbol, meaning apotheosis and the incarnation of the spirit of his age. His enemies turn out on this high plane to have been merely the material with which he hewed his deeds. This recall, and this is one of the odd things about Yaki's waxing poetic and idolizing and lionizing individuals here, is that earlier, as we recall, when he was attacking Darwinism, he made his beliefs clear that it's not really the people that are important. It's this idea or complex of ideas that he described as culture, spirit, soul, which comes first and expresses itself through the people. So to hear him speaking so respectfully and as if these individuals, these heroes that he's describing are important and key is a little bit at odds with what he described earlier, maybe my misunderstanding of him. But I don't think so. I mean, maybe it's the cost of jumping around within his work rather than reading it from cover to cover all in one sitting. But the other point here about his describing the enemies of the genius as passing into history, it hasn't happened, of course, with Hitler. Something changed there. Something broke. And, of course, I think it was the Jews. It was the fact that Hitler and the National Socialists directly confronted the Jews as no Europeans previously really had. Napoleon, although he said a few things about the Jews and like other leaders in Europe, had said certain things about the Jews that the Jews will point to and say is reflective of them being Jew haters or whatever. None had really confronted the Jews in such a stark and organized fashion as Hitler and the National Socialists did. And the Jews won, ultimately, that conflict, at least for the time being. And to this day, 70 years later, dominate, even though so many people are in denial of that and don't want to confront the fact that the Jews actually rule now. They ruled even before the National Socialists confronted them, but their power and their influence was flushed out into the open for all to see at that time in history. It has since been recovered, but it is being it's in the process of being uncovered right now. So there is still a time, a chance that 70 years on now, that what Yaki described will actually happen to Hitler, that Hitler's name will be written in brass letters, as he described, as he had hoped, right in the wake of the war, would happen right away. Third, and he's describing here the qualities of genius. Third, intensity. The voice of genius commands. It is harsh, intolerant. It demands and impels upward. Genius is inseparable from the presence of a rushing inner chaos, the prerequisite of formative work. Under a Frederick or a Charles XII, men will overcome tactical odds of 5-1, strategical odds of 30-1, but not under Loudon or the Archduke Charles or a Grant. These latter need crushing superiority to make up for their inner lack. Frederick, I'm guessing, is Frederick the Great, and Grant is Ulysses Grant of the first total war, the war between the states, the war of northern aggression, the United States, 1860s. The other names are not familiar to me. I'm left looking up on the internet to find out who these people are that Yaki is so familiar with that he sees so clearly. Fourth, the sense of a mission. This vision, purity, and intensity are all brought into an ethical focus. The things which he sees are stamped with necessity, the capital N, and he must actualize them. This accounts for the powerfully dramatic influence of a political genius upon the facts of history. His forceful mission compels everyone to orient himself to it. Everyone is either with him or against him. He becomes the center of the world. And here he's, again, he's attributing now to an individual genius what he previously associated and asserted was really just culture, spirit, soul, some amorphous thing that he really wasn't being very specific about in his earlier pages. But here he's coming clean, I think, in expressing it or seeing that it's expressed actually in real people. Lastly, and imponderable, genius is life at its highest human potential, and all life is uncanny, irrational, mysterious. There is something about genius that makes men rise spiritually. It is like something. It is the something, with a capital S, that gave Napoleon victory on almost every field, that sat like an eagle on the shoulder of Moltke, as he worked quietly at his task of shaping the form of the 20th and 21st centuries. It may be merely the personality accompanying these extraordinary gifts. It may be a transcendental emanation from the higher organism. There he's alluding to the spirit, the culture, the soul that he discussed earlier. It is unknowable, but it is there. So I thought, to get some perspective here, that it would be fitting to insert a little bit of what the hero himself had to say on these subjects of race and culture. And I found something just by chance, because I haven't read Mein Kampf from cover to cover. I've only read snippets. And I happened to run into this snippet just during this past week. It's from Volume 1 of Mein Kampf in the section that's titled A Retrospect, Chapter 11, titled Nation and Race, page 240. And remember, this is Hitler writing in 1924, 25 odd years prior to Yaki writing. He writes, "All that we admire in the world today, its science, its art, its technical developments and discoveries, are the products of the creative activities of a few peoples. And it may be true that their first beginnings must be attributed to one race. The maintenance of civilization is wholly dependent on such peoples. Should they perish, all that makes this earth beautiful will descend with them into the grave." And right there we see a distinction with the way that Yaki sees things and describes things, that that it's not the peoples, really. I mean, prior to this section where he starts talking about tradition and genius and his focus on specific individual examples of genius, Yaki was describing it as not coming from people, not having to do with people. And as I've said before, he talks about the Western civilization rather than the European people. Whereas Hitler takes this opposite tack, that it's about the people. In fact, he says that it's really only the people and the culture springs from them. He continues, "However great, for example, be the influence which the soil exerts on men, this influence will always vary according to the race in which it produces its effects. Dearth of the soul may stimulate one race to the most strenuous efforts and highest achievement, while for another race, the poverty of the soul may be the cause of misery and finally of undernourishment with all its consequences. The internal characteristics of a people are always the causes which determine the nature of the effect that outer circumstances have on them. What reduces one race to starvation trains another race to harder work. All the great civilizations of the past became decadent because the originally creative race died out as a result of contamination of the blood." This is Arthur de Gobineau's thesis of his book, The Inequality of Human Races, which he wrote back in the 1850s. And racialists, from that point at least on, through to Hitler writing in the 1920s, saw things the way that Hitler saw things. Yaki didn't like that view. He called that the 19th century view, and proposed a different way of seeing things, a wrong way.